Good morning. Good morning. The House Committee on Revenue for April 2nd, 2009 will come to order. This morning, committee, we have the pleasure of receiving the Enterprise Zone Report. Paul?
Mr. Chair and members who were here at the end of the 2007 session, Senate Bill 151 came through House Revenue Committee, and what that bill did was to extend the sunset on the Enterprise Zone program, and it also required a study to do some analysis, and the committee, after some deliberations, decided to assign that to Legislative Revenue Office. And so this is a result of that effort during the interim. What the report you see, Enterprise Zone Study, is our report to you based on Senate Bill 151. What we did was develop a methodology to address the questions that were in the bill. The bill specifically asked us to look at the effects of property tax incentives on state and local economies, public finance, and government services examined. And then it also required us to do some statistical analysis of change in measures of community economic hardship over time for those areas that have enterprise zones. We formed a review team to help guide us. And then as we had some personnel changes during the interim, we hired Ed Waters, who is here today, a former Legislative Revenue Office economist, who is an independent economist now, and he led the research. Mazin coordinated for us, and we got a lot of help from state agencies, and particularly the Employment Department. Art Ayer is here from the Employment Department, who provided us the base data in carrying out the study. We got some good input from Tony Ruffalo at Portland State, John Hart at Department of Revenue, and then from the counties. Doris Pinwell is here, who helped give us some direction, and Hasina Squires from the special districts, and also the League of Oregon Cities helped us. And we got a lot of help in particular from the folks who actually run the program, and that's Art Fish here from the Economic Development Department, who is the most familiar with the program, has been working with it for many years, and he really helped us try to put this together and try to summarize what we know and from the program. So anyway, I'll turn it over to them to go through the study, and then I just ask, if you have some real specific institutional questions about the program and how it's operating, then Art Fish will come up afterwards and address those questions.
Thank you, and before we actually get started, let me acknowledge that Representative Chris Edwards has joined us this morning, so we can tell that this study is of larger interest than the committee. Welcome, Representative Edwards.
Please. Thank you.
Please.
Chair Von Hart, members of the committee, for the record, Mazin Malik, Legislative Revenue Office. Just to add, later on this afternoon, we will also present to the committee economic development. That's Representative Reed's committee, and we will also bring that report to them. As Paul mentioned, in the Legislative Revenue Office, we really would want to express our deep appreciation for your task for us to do this report in the interim, that we have really tremendously enjoyed, and we bring this product in front of you out of a labor of love kind of thing. And, however, contrary to all reports, the market that is climbing the last 2 days is not a response to the report that we're producing today. But I have to say that we did get a lot of work. We put together a study review team, and just to acknowledge them, there was Art Ayer from the Employment Department, next to me, Tony Ruffalo from Portland State University, John Hart, Department of Revenue, who's probably not with the Department of Revenue anymore, but then was Doris Penwell, Hasina Squires, and from the League of Oregon Cities. We started with Andy Shaw, Willie Tiffany and Michael Novak were part of our team, and the team was involved in crafting the general direction of where the study is and how we go with it. The amounts of data and work that came with pulling the data that the employment department committed themselves to, the research section and art area in particular, the amounts of data mining and work and analysis and changing one direction from one time to another is really something that is commendable, and we could not have done it without them. I have to say some of the results were not necessarily obvious, nor what I expected to see out of the report. You would see in the first page highlights of these results, and those are the ones that we thought that not necessarily the most intuitive that would come out of the enterprise zone studies. We thought bring to your attention how in the long term some of the measures of economic welfare that came out in the study were pointing one direction on positive, others were pointing the other directions on the negative, well, or not much change. And then some of the analysis on the internal rate of return of how much in theory, does it cost us per job to have produced those into the enterprise zones? At this time, not to steal any of the thunder for the results that you will go through, let me just quickly go through the organization of the report for you. We have our introduction background and then the analysis methodology And then we would put in the tables from starting from page 7 of inferences and results, and then some of discussions of these results, and you have your summary and conclusions on page 19, recommendation for future research, page 20. I turn it to Ed Waters, who's been our principal researcher on this, and again... He will answer all the hard questions, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Mazen. I think that's why Art is here. thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Mazen. I'd like to reiterate my appreciation for the review group who sat with us for many long meetings and went through and honed our methodology and our process until I think we had a pretty good result. Also, I'd like to thank Art Fish from the Economic and Community Development Department for providing his data set and model for examining property tax exemptions. That was a critical piece of this analysis. And finally, again, thanks to Art Air for the heavy lifting, assembling the covered employment and payroll data and census data, identifying our comparison areas, and conducting the short-term and long-term sample analyses. I have here about 9 or 10 slides that provide a fairly quick summary of the research report. Mr. Chair, Paul, I'm not sure how you wanted to handle this. The presentation is probably brief enough. We could take questions in stream.
Okay. Anyone with a question, sing out. We'll recognize you.
Overview. We used simple methods to examine first-order measures of benefits and costs of enterprise zones. For benefits, on the benefits side, we examined change in covered employment between 2003 and 2006. Seems like a fairly short period, but 2003 and 2006 were the earliest and most recent available years, respectively, where spatially specific or geocoded employment and payroll data were available. Mm. Geocoding was necessary in order to be able to associate jobs with specific facilities in specific areas rather than being assigned to the administrative offices, wherever those might be. Also, census variables were used to examine benefits as broader socioeconomic effects over a longer period, and that is between the two censuses, 1990 and 2000. On the cost side, we used a data set developed by the Economic Community Development Department to extract estimates of property taxes foregone, post-exemption property tax collections, and also number of new jobs created in each enterprise zone. Enterprise zones were grouped for this study into five strata based largely on geography. The stratifications were urban metro, which is Portland, enterprise zones in the Portland metro area, urban Western Valley, which includes basically the I-5 corridor, rural West Side, which is enterprise zones in all other West Side counties other than urban metro and I-5 corridor. Fourth stratification is rural East Side, which are basically all counties east of the Cascades, with the exception of the final stratification, rural remote, which are a subset of East Side counties, those that are off major roads and far from population centers. There's a table in, or a couple of tables in the report, tables 1 and 2, I believe, that show, list the enterprise zones in each stratum that we analyzed. We selected two samples consisting of 1 to 5 enterprise zones each from each stratum, and these were used for analysis of benefits. There was two different samples, slightly different samples. One was used for analyzing the short-term benefits, which I'll describe, and the second sample was used for looking at the longer-term effects. Comparison areas were a big part of this study. Comparison areas, or really it was our control group. We didn't have a statistical control group per se, but we came upon this idea of using comparison areas to represent the conditions in non-enterprise zone areas in each of our sample strata. To determine candidates for possible matching, each census tract was assigned to a stratum based on county, and that grouping is shown in Table 3 in the research report. Matching was achieved by comparing private industry employment profiles of the sampleesees and the candidate tracts using a simple correlation factor. And those candidate areas which came closest to matching the enterprise zone's employment profile in each stratum were designated as our comparison areas. Our research methodology for analyzing short-term benefits simply compared change in private industry employment and payroll over the period 2003 to 2006 in the enterprise zones in our sample versus our comparison areas. And analysis of long-term benefits compared change in a group of census variables in the enterprise zones versus the comparison areas over the period 1990 to 2000. The census variables that we specifically looked at include poverty rate, unemployment rate, household income, housing vacancy rate, and median gross rent as a share of median income. And again, we looked at changes in those variables over our analytical period. On the cost side, our analysis involved using the Economic Community Development Department data set to calculate or estimate property taxes foregone per net new job created, and also calculate the number of years required to recoup the foregone property taxes. I can jump to our results without further ado. Our results, first of the short-term benefits analysis, show that growth in employment and payroll by participating enterprise zone firms was considerably stronger than what we observed in comparison areas. Also, there was really no discernible difference in growth between comparison areas and firms in enterprise zones that did not receive the tax exemptions, or that is, firms that were not participating in the enterprise zone program but were within the enterprise zone area. Also, it appeared that the rural east side enterprise zones outperformed comparison areas by the widest margin compared with the other strata. And growth in employment and payroll in rural remote enterprise zones was less than in comparison areas by a considerable margin. And lastly, growth in average pay for participating firms in enterprise zones was less than in comparison areas for all strata except urban metro stratum. As Mazen mentioned, the detailed results of the short-term benefits analysis are beginning table 5 and go through table 10. And that appears, I think, on beginning page 7 in the report. Continuing on, the results of our long-term benefits analysis show that the change in poverty rates in enterprise zones versus comparison areas was mixed. It was enterprise zones performed better in some strata and worse in comparison areas in others. Unemployment declined more or rose by a lesser amount than in comparison areas everywhere except the urban Western Valley enterprise zones. Changes in household income and housing vacancy rates were also fairly mixed. Couldn't really see a pattern there. And lastly, median rent declined. Median rent as the share of median household income declined more than in comparison areas in only one stratum, and that is the urban metro area. The detailed results, again, for this analysis are shown in tables 11 through 15 in the report. A last set of results to report here. Results of the property tax revenue and internal rate of return analysis show that about 7 years on average statewide are needed to recover the undiscounted value of enterprise zone property tax exemptions. The range observed among the different groupings was from 3 years to 11 years to recover the lost or the foregone dollar amounts. Statewide, about $11,000 in property taxes are foregone per net full-time job created. The range is quite wide, from about $1,100 to over $33,000 per job, depending on project and stratum. When you remove certain projects from that universe, power-generating projects and waiver projects, projects that are granted waiver from their sponsors, from the requirement to increase employment by 10%, then this reduces the value of foregone property taxes fairly substantially. So the result is now foregone property taxes per full-time job are about $7,800, and the range at the top end drops from $33,000 down to $12,600. So you can see the effect of removing those high capital investment projects from the analytical data set. Again, the results of the costs and internal rate of return analysis are shown in tables 16 through 18 in the report. Getting down to near the end here, some observations regarding our analysis, the lessons learned the hard way. 3 years is probably too short a period for this type of review. However, as I mentioned, 2003 and 2006 were the earliest and most recent years available with the spatially specific data, employment and payroll data that we needed. It also is apparent that enterprise zones in the rural remote stratum were not established long enough for us to be able to notice any long-term effects. And principally, of the three enterprise zones in our rural remote stratum, two were established only in 1996, so didn't really become active until 1997, and the third wasn't established until 1999. And so the year the 2000 census was actually administered was 1999. But we didn't have a choice in that case. Also some issues that people are interested in that we did not address in this analysis include property tax shifting, present value analysis using discount factors, effects on public finances of enterprise zone exemptions and projects, and finally, attribution of development impacts. However, there is some additional work available that in the economic and community development model, which we could probably bring to bear to, if not answer some of these questions, at least examine them with a little more rigor and in greater detail and be able to come up with some more inferences, at least. A final slide, a long list of recommendations, and that is for next steps. If we're going to do a continued analysis or a future analytical work on enterprise zones in this type of structure, it is recommended that we define our geographic strata next time around based on divisions smaller than counties, for example, census tracts. This would improve our ability to stratify and also increase the pool of candidate tracts available to use for identifying our comparison areas for each stratum. We had some difficulty with this for rural remote stratum where it was pretty thin pickings, let's say. Also, next time around, probably be advisable to use all enterprise zones in our analysis rather than only a sample of the enterprise zones. This would eliminate any possible sample selection bias. I'm not aware of any in this study, but it's one thing that you could rule out if you had used the complete universe of enterprise zones rather than only a sample. And I think we do have data available to do that in most cases anyway. Also, it would be nice to be able to use a longer series of data to make the employment and payroll comparisons, and possibly also using more sophisticated statistical methods to draw out the results and inferences in greater precision and detail. For the long-term analysis, it would be advisable to select the comparison areas by performing a match of the socioeconomic characteristics rather than matching the industry employment profiles as we did this time around. That should be possible. I'm sure there's some difficulties involved when you get down to it, but it's something to look at anyway. Also, it would be nice to be able to include a fuller accounting of benefits and costs next time around, including effects on public finances and provision of services, and also possibly including the economic impacts derived from project investments and employment in the enterprise zones. Another thing that wouldn't be too hard to do next time around, if you address this from the beginning, would be to include or examine the effect of discounting property tax estimates or calculating present values, and also using discounted property tax estimates to calculate the return on investment. There are some parameters in the economic community development model which would allow this type of analysis to be done, I think, pretty easily. And the last point on recommendations is that we should, I mean, everyone is interested in this question, be able to address whether property tax savings significantly induced the capital investment in the enterprise zones relative to what would have otherwise occurred. Again, this is the $64 million question, but I think that the structure in the economic and community development model includes some parameters that at least we can do some what-ifs. We could say, for example, okay, what if 20% of the investment is actually unique and would not have occurred under any circumstances without the exemption? Then these are the results. These are the benefits. These are the costs. So it would at least enable that those sort of questions to be asked. And that's that would be interesting to look at. Mm-hmm. That's my final slide. I'd be happy to take any comments, criticisms.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a very interesting presentation, and unfortunately I haven't had time to review this in detail, so I apologize if my questions are rudimentary or covered somewhere in this document. Is it correct to say that the Enterprise Zone program is a state-authorized program that has variability amongst local implementation authorities?
Perhaps Mazen would be a better situation to take this.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Bailey, I think that's probably a very close approximation to what the report is saying. It depends. And one of the surprises that we found while studying this at the absolute remote, the rural remote, it almost is non-responsive to enterprise zone projects. I mean, it's just not showing anything. Now, is that a result of not having enough time? Is it a result of not having enough projects? That remains to be seen. However, the idea of how the comparison areas in that part of the state are better off than the areas in the enterprise zones was really puzzling.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess focusing even in on, say, just urban enterprise zones, are there some that, for example, might have changes in local requirements around MWSB tie-ins, community contributions, various local implementation measures that might affect socioeconomic outcomes within a particular enterprise zone? I can wait for Art.
Probably is a question for. That might be the beginning of a next project.
And I guess, Mr. Chair, that's where my question was going. I was just curious to hear how those variances within each enterprise zone were accounted for, and if it's a 10-year abatement program that has to be applied for on a 10-year cycle. So if you have, for example, the urban ones, 86, 96, 2006, how you account for changes in the program across reapplication cycles.
Mr. Chair, Representative, one of the things that I think was variable, we probably were not able to go into that fine level of detail that you're looking for. However, I think the best thing that probably we were able to look with this mountain of data that we examined is for the first time. This is like, I don't want to. The analogy is when you know there is a body like a cave or something and you can't see inside of it, and you start digging a little bit and all of a sudden you could see about a few feet down, and now you start seeing the contours of the cave or how it looks like. I think that's the beginning of the light, if you will, that we started seeing now. That's how the results from these data is being analyzed. I think I think the next few feet down the cave is probably will carry the answers to your questions.
If I may, Chair Barnard, Vice Chair Bailey, we tried to account for some of the variability by stratifying, but within stratum, variability wasn't really addressed in this project. It would be a good thing to consider next time around.
Okay. How much further down the cave can you see with the data that is available or is becoming available, and how much or how important would it be to gather different data in order to answer some of the questions that you have raised in your recommendation section? I guess what I'm asking in general, at least, is what's the limitation of the data set, and are there ways that we could go about curing it for future studies?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Art Ayer, State Employment Economist for the Oregon Employment Department, and I'll talk just briefly about the data itself. As Ed and Mazen, I believe, both mentioned, the current data set that we have at the Employment Department, the Covered Employment and Payroll data set, is geocoded back to 2003 and actually now through 2007, but at the time that we did this analysis, which was a few months ago, we did not yet have the 2007 data geocoded. So we do have an additional year's worth now, and presumably in the future we will continue to have that capability to add years to the data. So we will have a longer and longer time series as we go into the future and be able to look at enterprise zones over a longer period of time. Also, probably by about 2013, we should have the results from the 2010 census, which actually the 2010 census is just going to be the short form, and so that won't have a lot of the socioeconomic data attached to it that we'd be interested in, but there is the American Community Survey data, which by the fall of 2010, will include areas down to about, I think, 2,000 population. So very small geographies comparable to census tracts. Unfortunately, those data down to that level of geography will be averages over a period of 5 years in order to get the statistical reliability that they want. So we won't have point-in-time data. We'll have 5-year average data down to essentially the census tract level starting in 2010. But that may help in a longer term study, for example, looking from 1990 to the 2005 to 2010 period, or something of that nature, may be valuable.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you explain to me talk a little bit about census tracts, and I mean, I'm not terribly familiar with the size of a census tract, and some of the tables refer to both data just in collected just from enterprise zones and comparison areas, and then others refer to data collected in census tracts overlying enterprise zones. So are census tracts generally larger or smaller, and how much overlap is there? And
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, census tracts range in size from probably in the neighborhood of 500 population to maybe as much as 3,000. It's the Census Bureau that determines the boundaries of census tracts, but they, I would say, average around 1,000 population, something like that. And in comparison to enterprise zones, of course, enterprise zones vary greatly in their dimensions and their population. What I did in analyzing these numbers was to pull a sample of essentially to pull comparison areas and select the comparison areas that best matched each enterprise zone's geographic area. I did not intentionally try to make the comparison areas match in aggregate size the enterprise zones, but in general they did. just more or less coincidentally. And I selected, in general, I think it was 10 comparison areas for each enterprise zone stratum, so that I wouldn't be relying on a single comparison area, so that I had a essentially kind of almost a random sample of comparison areas that would be more reliable as a grouping of comparison areas to compare the enterprise zone with. So I wasn't comparing the enterprise zone group just with a single comparison area, but rather with an aggregate of areas, census tracts, that best matched that enterprise zone group.
Representative Riley?
Thank you.
Was there something else?
No.
Well, did you want to... Representative Riley.
Chair, this is a very laudable goal to do these reports and look at the use of enterprise zones and how useful they are. One of the things you find about enterprise zones is that they are so variable that you could have one across the street from each other and they wouldn't look anything alike. One of the things that makes sense to me would be a comparison, and I think there was a little bit of this in this report, of the businesses within an enterprise zone which use the enterprise zone and businesses within the enterprise zone which don't use the enterprise system. I think that's a much more meaningful comparison than any that you could make.
Would you like to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, we did try to look at that. Some of our comparisons actually are directed that way. For example, if you look at Table 5 on page 7 of the report, the first block at the top of that table shows, is labeled employment in firms participating in the enterprise zone program within the sample disease. And there is the data associated with those firms. And then below that, the next block, employment in all firms in the sample disease.
Right.
So it's a little different than what you were talking about, I think, in that the lower block includes the firms participating in the enterprise zone and also the firms not participating that happen to be within the enterprise zone geographically. And we didn't stress comparisons much. I didn't stress comparisons much in this presentation, but someone could look at those tables and pull out some inferences, perhaps, at least as a starting point with regard to that question.
Chair?
Yes, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an interesting report. It's raised as many questions, if not more questions, than it's answered for me personally, but along the lines of what Representative Riley was perhaps getting at. I'm particularly interested in knowing whether or not the typical enterprise zone participant is a local distribution warehouse or is it a traded sector manufacturing plant, and because I would argue that one is going to have a significantly different economic impact for the state than the other. And so that type of analysis would be particularly interesting in the future for me. And so that's just a little bit of editorializing, I guess. I'm also interested in, drilling down what some of these things mean. I mean, I see that according to the report, employment growth in enterprise zones was significantly higher than in comparison areas on average across the state, although it wasn't in the urban metro one, but was not in overlying census tracts of enterprise zones. And I don't know what that means. So I'm trying to figure that out. Does that mean that the census tracts overlying enterprise zones overlie outside the boundaries, and there's just a stark line, and I don't know what it means, so.
One more, if I may.
Let's deal with this one first, and then we'll get to you.
Okay, sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I believe part of the difference that you're referring to has to do with the short-term versus the long-term study. The short-term study looked specifically at the enterprise zone boundaries because we had what were called shape files for those enterprise zones and geocoded data to position each company, almost every company. There are a few that are we're not sure exactly where they are, but for most companies, we know exactly where they are located. And so for the short-term study from 2003 to 2006, we were able to look at the actual number of firms within the enterprise zone and how their employment changed over time, or how the employment for firms within an enterprise zone changed over time. For the longer-term study, we didn't have geocoded data going back to 2000 or 1990. So what we used for that information was the census tract data, and we're looking at socioeconomic indicators for those census tracts that overlay the enterprise zones. Now, of course, we still have the enterprise zone boundaries and assume that they remain the same over that period of time, but going back into 1990, we had to use census tract data for census tracts that overlay those geographic areas corresponding to enterprise zones. And so there are two different time periods. I think that's maybe what you're referring to, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I don't think so, but I'd be happy to talk with you offline, but table 10 would be an example of what I'm trying to figure out. What so average private sector pay? Excuse me. Can I follow up, Mr.
Yes,
Chair?
Please. Yes, go ahead.
Average private sector pay in 2003 and 2006 in tracts overlying enterprise zones, and in all other tracts by sample stratum. And that's what I'm trying to understand. In tracts overlying enterprise zones, and it's comparing 2003 to 2006 data.
Okay. Thank you very much for elucidating that. Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, if I recall correctly, and it's a little bit difficult to bring myself back in time to exactly how we did this. It's been a few months. I believe because we had data that allowed us to look at census tract level, it was easy to do the analysis not only for the individual enterprise zone for the 2003-2006 study, but also for the census tracts themselves. And one of the provisions in the bill, as I recall it, was to look at the economic impact of enterprise zones. And some of those impacts may fall outside the specific boundaries of the enterprise zones. So we were able to look at census tracts that overlay the enterprise zone, some of which stretch substantially beyond the enterprise zone. And by looking at those census tracts that touched the enterprise zones, including overlay them overlay them a little bit and then stretch beyond them, we were able to get information on a broader geographic area but still very close to the enterprise zone and look at that that trend.
Thank you for that clarification, and in fact, that is what was really interesting to me, Mr. Chair, is the difference in a couple of those data sets mm-hmm. when you look at the tracts overlying enterprise zones mm-hmm. versus the same data measure for the enterprise zone itself. And there were a couple, I'd have to go back and figure out which ones, but there were a couple where there was a difference between those two mm-hmm. tables. Mm-hmm. And so wondering what that means.
Mr. Chair, if I may add for Representative Edwards, I think the classification by industry, whether this business is warehouse versus a manufacturing, that is a thing that is possible to do, I think, by industry strata, what kind of industry there is. However, there are within the enterprise zone statutes a requirement for employment. So regardless of the what the business is, these employment conditions have to be met. And the second point is, I think what we were trying to answer, as you correctly stated, is the answer to the question whether the rising tide of the enterprise zones lifts all boats kind of thing within around it. And that's These are the two different questions, and they, you know, you would see from different answers from the previous tables to like table 10, and that probably could be taken with the longer term if the data starts allowing with time. The short term, we took only three main characteristics of employment. The number of employment, income, and payroll. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And those were very three specific measures that we looked at versus the other types in the long term, where we're looking at poverty rate, ownership of housing, and so on. So that a different to see if there's a different impact with time that is actually translating into the welfare of the surrounding area of the enterprise zone, and is it giving that benefit to everybody around it, kind of thing.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, my memory is coming back even more fully. There's one additional difference between the enterprise zone sample results that you were referring to and these census tracts overlying enterprise zones, and that is that in the sample analysis, we were looking only at a sample of enterprise zones. In the census tracts overlying enterprise zones, because we didn't do a study using shapefiles for every enterprise zone, we did a separate analysis with census tracts looking at the census tracts that overlay every enterprise zone in the state. It wasn't just a sample of enterprise zones, it was every enterprise zone in the state. But we were able to do that with census tracts because we had the census data and could match those up with enterprise zones. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the future, I'm very interested in something that Representative Edwards alluded to, and that's industry type. It seems to me a very important question whether a company who takes advantage of an enterprise zone is better or worse or the same as a company which does not take, of the same type, which does not take advantage of the enterprise zone. I think that's the crux of the matter in my mind is if that industry in the enterprise zone had not been in the enterprise zone, how would it have reacted? And we can look at some outside or not taking advantage of and maybe find the answer.
Mr. Chair, I think this is a perfect completion of the example. We will make that opening of the hall bigger, and we have bigger lights.
That's why I said for the future.
But with appropriations, hopefully next time, Mr. Chair.
Oh, no.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, Paul and I were just talking here, and he illuminated for me how little resources were directed at this study and how much time you all put in of your own time above and beyond the resources that were dedicated to it. So I want to thank you for putting so much of your time and donating your time to the study, and you've come up with a lot of really remarkable work for a small investment.
Yes, Representative Brun.
Well,
thank you, Representative Bailey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for saying that, Representative Bailey. That was very appropriate and absolutely true. My question, and given the light of the limited resources that were put into this, this is a broader question and more of a policy question. I'm always, and I guess it's not part of your study. It would be part of your thoughts regarding enterprise zones in light of the study that you did. Part of my thinking has always been that there hasn't really been an evolution in the policy structure of enterprise zones for a long time. I mean, with my limited understanding of it, I think that at least the current version of enterprise zones came about sort of in the late 70s, early 80s. I think they sort of germinated out of Great Britain and made their way over here. But my question is, especially in Oregon, we've largely been a property tax exemption-driven sort of enterprise zone. And to me, that leaves a whole bunch of things potentially on the table as attractants or stimulants to employers and or industrial endeavors that might not otherwise come. The regulatory burden in general, and one could go along the line of minimum wage, certain environmental regulatory standards, almost looking at it in effect that you reduce the barrier down to the point where you're protecting human safety, but much beyond that might be on the table. And that's way open-ended, but is it time for an evolution in our thinking in the enterprise zones? Are they as effective just hitting on that one target as they've always been? And I realize that's an open-ended question.
I've been known to venture into places where I shouldn't have.
Welcome. The water's warm.
President Bruin, enterprise zones from the study, they work somewhat. They work, but they're probably not the answer to all the questions. They have benefits to them. However, that benefit in some eyes might be greater than other eyes. I mean, that's obviously what the results from the study is. They have increases, they cause increases in employment, in income, and so on from the other places. But whether that was a product of where the enterprise zones was assumed, and where it was concentrated, or whether it was actually just because enterprise zone happened, that is a different question. So there are things, sometimes enterprise zones and the tax breaks, it is something that you cannot escape because you're competing against the state on the other side that gives the same kind of exemption. And if you don't give the exemption, you might lose rather than gain. So you're trying to equalize the playing field, if you will, rather than get an advantage. That's not always true in all cases, but that's sometimes where you are. So if you look at, for example, the internal rate of return, it's costing you, in some places, up to $33,000 per job. In some other states, it's known to cost a lot more than that. In other enterprise zones, it costs a lot less than that and gives the same or better benefit to doing it. So all these questions, probably sometimes, if you want to measure it as which is the most effective, how much does it cost, you probably have to venture and look at the competitive advantage that is given you compared to other states and other places and so on. This probably the third step after the second project that is coming. It'll be the third project that we would go through. And it'll be an interesting question to answer, but that's saying all what I had said without necessarily going into the lines. So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruin.
I don't know if you answered my question, but I'm not going to ask anymore. I'd like to hear the next.
I was going to try to get there a little more directly, maybe, probably deeper water. But the enterprise zone, your little history lesson about enterprise zones was very apt, I think. They came out of a time when our property tax structure was very much different than it is now. And while our property tax structure has changed considerably since the early 1990s, the enterprise zone incentives really haven't. So maybe your point is well taken. It's time to think things through and see maybe there are some tweaks that could be done to improve the effectiveness of the incentives available under a program like that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do you have time for another question? I know you're on a schedule.
I think we'll take one more.
Okay.
Please.
I appreciate your indulgence both in allowing me to ask another question and allowing me to sit on the panel today.
Well, I have to say I appreciate your being here today because you asked several very useful questions.
It occurs to me that, I guess my question is how difficult was it to find comparison areas? And the reason I ask this is in my community, without sitting down and looking at a map of where our enterprise zones, plural, are, It occurs to me just off the top of my head that they happen to be located in the areas with the most available buildable land and the best infrastructure for development anyway. So I'm wondering, an analysis of those, of the effectiveness of those enterprise zones versus, well, I'm not sure that actually that there are comparable areas right next door. And so you would have to go to a different geography of the state, and in which case would skew things. And so I'm struggling. I'm fairly agnostic on the issue, actually, and I just want to get it right.
Yeah.
For economic development in the state.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, the way I did most of the work on that part of it, the way I selected comparison areas was to divide the census tracts in the state up into the five strata. So we have these five geographic strata. And so the comparison areas were pulled only from the census tracts within the same stratum as the sample enterprise zones, and only from those census tracts that did not overlie another enterprise zone that might not be in the sample or that was in the sample. So had to be a census tract that was in the same broad geography, similar geographic area, and also had to not overlie an enterprise zone. And beyond that, it had to have a similar employment structure. And the employment structure, admittedly, was based on a very broad broad industry grouping. So, for example, in the 1990 to 2000 sample, I believe I was using only about 10 to 12 industries, basically. So it was a very broad grouping. And that's why I got some very high correlations. In the 2003-2006 sample, I was looking at about, I think, 17 industry groupings. And so correlations were a little bit lower. But nevertheless, it was based on the similarity of the employment, or the structure of the economy, if you will, based on employment, in these other census tracts. And there was no attempt to isolate the census tracts that were just next door, as opposed to at the other end of the stratum geographically. They had to be within that same geographic stratum, but they had to have a similar employment structure and not overlie an enterprise zone.
But not similar available land or transportation infrastructure structure.
That is correct.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just want to bring your attention to, we have on page 5 of the report a listing of how these things we looked at in the comparison areas. I just would like to emphasize, at one point we were looking at level of grouping based on the Hutchman Index, and we did a lot of work with Art did a lot of work with that. We kind of emotionally worked with him. And that did not come up with the same results that we were hoping that it will come up with. So there was a reset in strategy at that time, and we went with a simple correlation between, you have two geographic areas or census tracts, that is. You have two mixes of industry. How do these mixes of industry compare in correlation types? And that's in the table 4 where you would have those correlations that we are looking at, and therefore you could see that we were able to come up with a lot better correlation index to work with in the comparison areas than otherwise when we started.
Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you very much, and let me echo Representative Bailey's thanks for the extra effort that you put into preparing this report. I think you've given us as is often the case with reports of this sort, it points more toward what we might do for further study than giving us definitive information now, but those of us who are familiar with social science and or economics probably aren't terribly surprised about that. We appreciate it very much. Did you want to hear from Mr. Fish? Were there some questions that you think he might be able to
Mr. Chair, I think Art Fish might be able to answer the question on industry types. That's, I think, was the one that Representative Riley and Representative Edwards both ask, and because he's very familiar, he's the manager of these programs for the Economic Development Department, so he's very familiar with the characteristics of those zones.
So, you go as Penuel and Asinas Cuadras out here.
And Mr. Chair, I'm very happy to hear that you separated social science and economics as being two distinct things. Dismal science, I believe, and social science.
I wondered about that, too.
They do use similar techniques often. I did note that the answer to the question I asked about data sets basically was, we use the data we've got. And that's a useful information as well. Whereas the social scientists, of course, will try to go out and gather some additional data if there's any way to do that. There may not be in many cases. Yes, sir. Do you understand the question that Representative, was it, who was it, Representative Riley that asked that question?
I was one of the two, yes.
Yeah. Could you restate it, perhaps? And
sure. I've been looking at enterprise zones for a few years, not as long as you have, but one of the things that strikes me is the useful comparison would be an industry or a company, actually, that takes advantage of an enterprise zone and a similar company which does not take advantage of the enterprise zone, and especially if they're in the same area.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Riley, members of the House Revenue Committee, my name again is Arthur Fish with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, Business Incentives Coordinator, and if I have just a few comments I'll indulge you with if you allow me a little after I answer some questions here. But to Representative Riley's point, yes, there is variability among industries, and there certainly are industries and or businesses in any given industry that can or does use an enterprise zone that are not in an enterprise zone or may not be able to meet the criteria even if they are in an enterprise zone. the vast noise, if you will, within the economy is represented by a lot of retail and service sector stuff, as I think we all can observe every day. And those types of activities are themselves not direct, cannot directly use an enterprise zone or most any type of economic development thing. The enterprise zones don't use this term, but essentially they do relate to the traded sector type of thing. The companies with a national, international type of competitive situation, directly or indirectly in terms of what they do, not the retail household sector. And, that includes manufacturing and distribution centers, which you've both noted. And getting to the data, and I'm flattered by Ed Waters' comment about my model, but we did look back over 10 years of data, program data, as opposed to the employment data and the geo data, but the program data that comes through the tax administrators from the businesses and so forth. And, that was about 400 companies or 400 projects in there. There's actually about 460 projects, but about 400 companies, because we do have repeat customers, and across the state. And one of the ways, there's work in progress here all over the place, and one of my things to do in case I get bored is to go in and really shore that up with NAICS type codes and so forth. That, of course, would pinpoint, various manufacturing and other types of activities, and that would be, I think, a useful way to go, both on sort of a more in-plan type, cost-benefit type analysis, or just more your type of issue, which is just sort of focusing in on sort of the looking at what are some of the unique characteristics among enterprise zones and among the industries that may be using certain enterprise zones versus non-enterprise zone areas or, various, and I think that's where you were kind of getting, and I do agree that's very useful work, and, there's nothing like having a few more biennia be consumed with analysis as opposed to my other duties. So, I found your points very very well, but we're not really quite there yet. One of the advantages of doing something that involved all the enterprise zones is that you could really just provide every representative with a data for their particular zones and other zones, and there might be a lot of it may not be very scientific, but it might be very informative, you know, to be able to look at each zone and see how certainly a West Eugene Enterprise Zone has performed, or a Redmond Enterprise Zone, which is certainly the communities have done a great job of providing for good areas where businesses can grow. And the last thing we would ever try to say is that an enterprise zone on its own is going to do that much for you. You need to have other tools in place. And you know, and I can answer Representative Bailey's question as well, that there is variability as far as what local areas. Have I perhaps completed your needs, Representative? Okay, very good. To Representative Bailey, Vice Chair Bailey's points, yes, there is quite a bit of variability that local sponsors can bring to, you know, how these things can get awarded or be, in effect, encumbered with other criteria or requirements. There are limits. I mean, this is, like any tax thing, this is a very statutorily based program. You know, the legislature is probably the leading partner in all this, as it has to be with any type of thing that involves taxes. But yeah, there is grounds. Now, going back to this sample and so forth, the only enterprise zone I think had a lot of notable types of local policies has been the Portland zone. And in that stratum, it was basically the stratum. I mean, we have a few other zones more recently that in the future could be studied, and one could look at what their local policies were, or what some of the local policies are that both rural and urban zones bring to maybe the longer 5-year type exemptions and so forth. But just to get to a point about the incentive, it is a property tax exemption, which is by its nature somewhat non-surgical, and not more, and the potency of it for any given project can vary tremendously. So I mean, those are all issues that, you know, I think I was trying to explore in my model. You know, I use that term with gratitude, but it is very good. So, have I covered some of the outstanding issues?
Yes,
Representative Bailey.
Thank you for that follow up, Art. And I would imagine that you use the phrase encumbered as a technical term as opposed to a value statement on the additional measures.
Well. Yes and no, Representative Bailey, members of the House. I mean, anytime you add complexity or anything, you are in effect making it more harder for the incentive to, you know, serve its primary goal, which is to induce or motivate. So, you know, I mean, I don't wish to be pejorative in that by any means, but at the same time, I would note that, you know, any complexity, any rigmarole, however well-intended and however not very cumbersome on the bottom line of the business investment, is still going to be difficult. Now, if it's well-administered, if the people in Portland, as I well know, do a great job of helping companies to work with the systems and things they put in place for minority hiring or to serve local communities better, then yeah, it certainly can help. And there's other type of work which you may be familiar with that would look into how those policies themselves play a role and can be effective at serving other community type objectives.
Paul, yes, Mr. Mm-hmm. That raises a very interesting point, Mr. Fish.
Yes.
You said the if I remember correctly, and I'm paraphrasing, that the point is to induce or to motivate a behavior, and I'm curious, is that the objective of enterprise zone, or is it economic development? Is it the goal, or is it the tool?
Well, that's the means to an end, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Representative Bailey. Yeah, I mean, if you want to look at it, you're trying to affect business behavior. Now, the end result of that, which I think some of this data helps, is encouraging. I mean, as far as just having salient results show up, given, you know, that we're working with a small segment of the employment world and traded sector, I mean, the fact that this is very encouraging stuff in that respect, just given the difficulty and complexity of trying to ferret that out. But, yeah, I mean, the objective of enterprise zones is ultimately economic development, but more so economic development in areas that are a little, shall we say, behind the curve in terms of where they start. And I should point out, really, and I think this was risen, but if you kind of look at the study between the short term and the long term, you can see that the comparison areas were, in effect, generally somewhat better off to begin with as far as just basic economic conditions at the beginning of the study period or whatever you want to say. They weren't chosen on that basis. They weren't chosen to be as bad off initially as the areas that were enterprise zone samples. And so the fact that the sample areas, not just the enterprise zone firms, but the sample areas from in the short-term data did seem to outperform, sort of inconclusive and mixed, but they did do a little better in general than the comparison areas, I think is noteworthy. I mean, that would be the objective, is to improve the relative economic development in somewhat lagging or distressed or hardship areas, and to do that by encouraging greater private sector activity in the manufacturing and other eligible areas.
Paul, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. So if that is the objective, then to the extent that an encumbrance does not remove a motivation but enhances the ultimate goal of economic development, would it therefore be if the data indicated that encumbrance achieved that economic development outcome, would it therefore be positive?
And again, there are, and again, one of the things I wish to correct with, you know, with Paul's comments is we don't, quote, run the program, not least on the tax side of things. It's really run by 106 cities, 36 counties, about 7 ports or so, a tribe. The Department of Revenue plays a role, of course, as well as the legislature by virtue of providing us with such a nice bunch of statutes. So, and those statutes have requirements, not just the basic job requirements, but everything. So you're going to have, you know, for any type of program like this needs criteria and programs. And if local areas wish to bring those sorts of things, and maybe they bring other incentives to the table, or they bring programs that they're trying to work with companies at, yeah, I mean, you can do sort of things, and there could be other more detailed, more specific, more targeted, more locally appropriate types of objectives that can be served for the general purpose of economic development. So, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to deal with, you know, I'm one person playing a certain role with a larger program, which does have fairly simple requirements, thankfully, I think, just from our ability to administer matters and help and communicate. And the fact that, you know, a lot of rural communities may not have the wherewithal or the interest in the sorts of things that a Portland does. I mean, this is a very diverse state, and the enterprise zones, largely rural in nature, I think do serve that diversity very well. So there's much more than the simple objectives to be had, but I think those are best dealt with locally, in my personal opinion.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Fish brings out a point that we tend to forget, and that is the original purpose of the enterprise zones was to bring those distressed or underutilized areas up to the rest of the state and that was the original goal. It wasn't to develop for the state, but it was to bring those zones, those depressed areas up. That was the original goal.
Yeah. To your point, Representative Bailey, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, absolutely so. And I don't wish to overemphasize that these are necessarily the poorest of the poor or anything like that. I mean, it's just there's relative measures that are brought to bear as far as where you can put these zones within communities. And, of course, within urban areas, you know, that can get fairly specific. And you can't control for all the spillover effects that might occur between companies. We do, of course, control relocation within the state. That's prohibited within certain parameters. But, you know, as far as people and where people come from that get jobs and so forth, you know, there's a lot there that you can't control necessarily. But there is that great degree of variability in the fact that it is to be targeted to a degree at areas that are perhaps less successful to begin with.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate the additional elucidation.
My pleasure, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. It's always great, and I very much appreciate the work. And just to put it mildly, there was an enormous data work, especially by Art Air and Ed and Mazin and so forth, as well as, I'm very happy to have put in my blood and sweat into it, too. And, you know, the enormous data work and a lot of very clever ideas, but still, you know, obviously there's various ways to do things. This is somewhat rudimentary at this point. And so I encourage you as a partner with the Enterprise Zones to not only request, but support this kind of activity in terms of research and understanding of what we're doing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And let me, as you're moving away from the witness table, let me just say that I really appreciate the effort that went into, and as you say, the cleverness of the use of the data that actually is available to try to tease out the information that that this report gives us, and I, for one, appreciate it very much. Thank you. With that, we'll close the information meeting and open a public hearing on House Bill 2809. Thank you, Representative Edwards, for your attendance today. Hey. Good morning. Okay. Yeah. So we have someone joining us by phone. So we'll start that now.
Hi, Jeff. This is the Legislative Revenue Office.
Hi. How are you?
Oh, fine, thank you. Here's Chair Barnhart and the members of the committee. We're hearing on, House Bill 2809.
And we're in public session. A number of other people are in the room, and we're also live on the Internet. Please, go ahead, Dave.
Morning, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. House Bill 2809, this bill offers an option for municipalities to convert urban renewal plan from so-called standard rate plan to reduced rate plan for consolidated billing rate purposes. By the way, consolidated billing rate is the sum of the billing rates of all taxing districts that impose taxes in a given coded area. The amount of property taxes an urban renewal plan receives is calculated by applying the consolidated billing rate to so-called excess value, the growth in assessed value in the urban renewal area. There are two different ways to define the consolidated billing rate. One is standard rate plan. It includes property tax rates for general obligation bonds and local option levies approved by voters after October 6, 2001. And the other one is called a reduced rate, and it excludes these tax rates. Currently two municipalities, the City of the Dells and the City of Lake Oswego, are under standard rate plan. When a municipality with standard rate plan opts to convert to reduced rate plan, by the way, in the statute, you will not find standard rate or reduced rate as the term coined for convenience purpose. When a municipality with standard rate plan opts to convert to reduced rate plan, the consolidated billing rate will either go down or stay the same, depending on whether the municipality approved general obligation bonds and or local option levies after October 6, 2001. For example, in the case of the City of the Dells Columbia Gateway Urban Renewal Plan, a bond levy was approved for Columbia Gorge Community College, and the fiscal year 2007 and 2008 rate for that bond was $0.4022 per $1,000 assessed value. Now, if the city opts to convert to reduced rate plan, this bond rate will not be used for urban renewal plan, and the taxpayers are expected to save about $22,000 a year based on the access value of $56 million. You will...
Now, you're referring to the taxpayers in the inside the urban renewal area.
Yes.
That money will have to be made up by other taxpayers.
Yes. The urban renewal plan will get less money.
that money.
Oh, the urban renewal plan gets less money.
Yes.
The bonds will still be paid.
Yes.
By the same taxpayers.
Right.
Thank you. Okay, that helps me understand the issue a bit. All right. We need the list, yeah. Okay, right over here in front of us.
And Jeff?
Yes.
Would you like to testify?
Yeah, I would just like to, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a bill that allow the DAOs to work more closely with the taxing districts that are affected by urban renewal. And what they want to do is extend their urban renewal plan and increase the financial capacity of it to complete projects that they have not yet been able to complete. And they want to make a change to their plan to allow them to complete these projects, but they have worked very closely with the overlapping taxing districts that are affected by the urban renewal, and they want to be able to not impact the desires of these taxing districts to ask their voters for new bond levies or new local option levies. And under the current law, they're forced to have an impact on those bond levies and local option levies. And what they want to do is be able to become like all new urban renewal districts since 2001 and not affect these levies. So the idea that is if the city or the fire district or the community college wants to ask their voters to approve a local option or a new GO bond, with this bill, they'll be able to say every penny that you pay is going to go toward the bond or the local option, and none of this money that we're asking you to pay will go to urban renewal. So it's a hope on the part of the city to impact less the overlapping taxing districts, and they're willing to forego tax increment revenue in order to get to that place.
Okay. And I assume that also means that those who might oppose a levy will have one less argument to make.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Would you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Jeffrey Tashman, and I'm a consultant to the City of Bedell.
Great. Are there questions for Mr. Tashman? Representative Berger. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This may not. This may be for committee staff. So this only impacts two municipalities, just like as we go in the Dells.
Yes.
Thank you.
Those were the only two municipalities that had a plan that was in existence before the effective date of Measure 47 at the end of 1996, and they attempted to comply with the provisions of the law at that point, and the ordinance that they passed was referred to the voters and defeated. So it left them in a class of two urban renewal agencies in the state.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Tashman? Thank you very much. We appreciate your being available by phone and your testimony before the committee today.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think we're finished with him. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on House Bill 2809? Representative Reed, you heard this bill earlier in your committee. Was there additional testimony?
Mr. Tashman was there. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe we may have heard, my memory is a little bit hazy, as it's been a few weeks ago. Perhaps the Vice Chair can recall as well. I think we may have heard from the League of Cities. I noticed there's a letter from them today.
Yeah.
But it does, I think, seem to be largely a matter of timing. That seemed to be one point of clarity from our hearing about these two cities who were caught as a result of the timing around their particular situation. So it seems like a fairly narrowly aimed concept.
It certainly does. Is staff satisfied that this bill will make the change that Mr. Tashman is talking about?
Mr. Chair, yes.
And I notice we're just passing around an amendment which appears to be the addition of an emergency clause to put the bill into effect on its passage. That what that is?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. Is there anything else then on for the public hearing on House Bill 2809? Seeing nothing, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2809. Any announcements? We do meet tomorrow, and I will see you all then. Thank you. Committee's adjourned.